This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
You're listening to the best of FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio presents.
FUBAR Radio presents.
Politics on FUBAR.
Good afternoon and welcome to Politics on FUBAR. It's Asa Bennett here. Mr. Stanley Johnson, welcome.
Well, delighted to be here.
Ah, yes. Now, you've got a splendid new book, which I know you launched last night, Compromat, we can show to the camera. This being of a very sort of rollicking read, in a sense, of Russian intrigue.
I tell you, I said to myself, how can it be, thinking of what was going on in the United States and the apparent involvement of Russians in the evolution of the American political campaign there, including the election of Donald Trump, I said to myself, how can it be that the Russians weren't involved in the whole Brexit campaign? Because this was a natural one, I said to myself, for the Russians. I mean, it's a clear gain for them to have, you know, Britain coming out of the EU, to have the sheer chaos, which is now apparent not just in Britain, but really, I think, in Europe too, all the effort Europe is making to deal with the Brexit situation. So I said, well, hang on a moment. Maybe the Russians were involved. You see what I mean? So I then got back to constructing, ex post, if you like, the thriller which we have, which actually ends on June the 8th this year.
Election failure for the Prime Minister, and she's back.
Yes, but maybe an election triumph for
the Kremlin.
For the Kremlin. Yes, exactly. And I've rather, you know, in a funny way, the idea came to me when I was in St. Petersburg for about 3 full days at a meeting called by President Putin. I mentioned this right at the beginning, to save the world's tigers. And I thought, this is a guy who's such a star. He can do almost anything he wants. He got heads of state from all the countries around the world who had tigers. And I said, well, just imagine a situation where he and the American presidential candidate are off there in the Russian Far East, and by chance, the American presidential candidate, who's obviously not called Trump, I call him Craig, Ronald Craig, gets shot in the backside by the president of Russia, who's called Popov, not Putin, obviously.
And he wanted to pop someone off as a such.
Yes, Popov. And, you know, gets pinned by a hypodermic dart because they're trying to tranquilize the tiger. And maybe what if that hypodermic dart, you know, contained also a transmitting device? Anyway, it flows from there.
It's an excellent plot in that
flows
sense.
From there. Well, it goes on. I'll tell you, my problem was I kept on fiction, kept on being overtaken by reality.
No, indeed. The thing is, I'm worried that if we could almost end up reading the book out loud right now, in a sense. But if I could bring you towards sort of fiction to real life with the EU referendum itself, it's fascinating when you're saying the parallels, because Ben Bradshaw, Labour MP for Exeter, who I'll be later interviewing in the show...
Oh, well, that's interesting.
He said it was highly probable Russia had wanted to interfere with the referendum.
Yes. Now, he made that remark, I think, in the House of Commons. I haven't never heard him sort of pursue it, or maybe I haven't pursued...
He wants the government to inquire into this, actually.
Well, I think it'd be a very good idea if the government did, and they might come up with a kind of... my theory, according to this book, as you may get to grips, is actually it's a very deep Brexit, a very deep laid plot by the British Prime Minister, who's not obviously called David Cameron, he's called Jeremy Hartley, but he's a patriot, this guy, and deep down, you see, he wants Britain to leave. I mean, I said to myself, looking back on it, how could it be that a chap who was a careful politician, as Cameron was, could actually include the commitment to have a referendum in the Conservative Manifesto, or in the Bloomberg speech about a year
before. Well, he was so breezily confident, didn't realise.
You know. Well, no. That's where I go back.
If I could just ask one question, more on Russia. Then you were saying that there probably should be an investigation into the Russian interference. Do you think it's likely they were interfering, or they had an interest?
I said, when I first answered your question, I found it amazing to imagine that a man as clever and as able and as well-resourced as Putin didn't take all the opportunities to intervene in Brexit, which he obviously did take in the case of Trump. And this book, of course, covers not just Britain, but Trump as well. So, yes, I think that I'm absolutely sure if we dug deep, we would uncover some nuggets. Now, whether they're the nuggets which I have uncovered in my imagination,
of course,
I can't tell.
But you understand the mindset of the Russians and how they...
Why on earth? I mean, this is a win-win situation. It costs almost nothing to destabilize Britain in this way. I mean, nothing at all. Now, of course, when we get down to it, there have been investigative journalists probably also from the Times, but certainly from the Guardian. There's a lady called Carol Cadwallader who's written some long stuff about the funding.
Dark money.
Dark money and the funding of agencies. I think one is called Cambridge Analytica and the other is called Intelligence something or other, funded actually by an American. I think his name was Mercer or something like that. Well, okay, that doesn't give you the
Have you brought this up with your son? He was a leading vote leave man. So
he's a fine man and absolutely right. And he, you know, he is, I'm absolutely sure, completely on top of this. And of course, he's not only in charge of the Foreign Office, he's in charge of MI6 and he's in charge of GCHQ. Well, look, I don't want anybody to get too excited about this. This is only a thriller. This is only a thriller. I'm not making a political point. I'm not saying Brexit shouldn't happen. I'm not saying it should have happened.
But just imagine the fun of Russia, you know, sort of cackling away as they see the state that Britain is in this scenario.
Well, yes. I mean, and he does cackle. He does cackle. And in fact, I have a situation right at the end of the book where Mrs. May is announcing she's going to be calling the June 8th election, and Putin is actually checking off the draft text on his, you know, on his iPhone in front of her. Yes, you got that right. I mean, I'm glad that's the text she sent me in advance, and so on and so forth. Oh, I'm sorry, I had in advance. I don't mean she sent me in advance. He had the text, because you've got to assume that basically they know what's going on.
Oh, yes. But then if I can appeal to another book I know you've written. You wrote two series. One, Stanley, I Presume, and Stanley, I Resume. That's about you, your life, the family.
Indeed it was.
But can I ask then about the impact as a family man? It was a sort of vibrant, intelligent people, the Johnsons, who were all on various sides of the Brexit divide. You had Rachel, who was from Remain, I believe, and so much so she joined the Liberal Democrats.
Yeah, well, she did. I think they made quite a fuss.
I mean, how's
Rachel.
The family? Is Sunday lunches awkward or no?
Well, we were all together last night, I can tell you, together at the launch of this book. Look, there have been plenty of political families where people in the families have taken different political perspectives. I mean, think of the Foote family, for example. You had Hugh Foote, you had Michael Foote, you had Dingle Foote. You know, these are people, all of whom came out of the different origins. I can't think that matters too much. Yes, okay. You know,
is there a Johnson consensus on Brexit, at least? A sort of cautious optimism, or, you know?
Well,
how is it?
I don't think we could go so far as to say we have a Johnson consensus on this. I think we have a Johnson consensus on that we are where we are.
Yes.
That we are where we are. Although I think you could say that somebody who actually voted for the Lib Dems presumably would sign up to the Lib Dem policy of having a second referendum. Now, there is a little wrinkle here, because you could say, if as a result of this investigation which you were just talking about, people discovered, say the Electoral Commission discovered, that there really was, you know, Russian involvement or malfeasance or something or other, then you could say to yourself, well, maybe actually, you know, this would be regarded as interference with the electoral process. Maybe the referendum would be deemed to be null and void, or maybe the Electoral Commission would say it'll have to be rerun. Maybe our Supreme Court would say that. So, I mean, down the line, of course, the stakes are enormous, enormous. And you know, who knows? It might be jolly convenient for a prime minister, I don't know which one that would be, further down the line, to say, well, look, folks, I mean, we went into this referendum with good heart. Of course, we got the result, which we're all ready to respect. But if it turns out that result was actually caused by, you know, interference by foreign bodies and so on, well, might there not be a case for rerunning the referendum?
Sure, there wouldn't be enough, though, because we had the second mandate, in a sense, of the general election, and the lion's share of votes went to two parties, Labour and the Tories, who both committed to Brexit.
This is an interesting point. I think this is a very interesting point. Yes, it is true if you add the two parties together on that election, you would get a mandate for Brexit. But I tell you, even that mandate looks as though it's, you know, soft at the edges.
Yes.
I mean, I'm looking at, I don't know how up to date we can be, but I'm looking at today's reaction of the Labour Party to the bill as laid yesterday, the repeal bill. I see they've dropped the word great.
It's just a repeal bill.
Yeah,
bog standard bill.
Bog standard repeal bill. Well, I'm interested by this because if you look at the areas where the Labour Party has said they're going to object, these are pretty fundamental areas. So you have to say to yourself, well, fine, they got it in their manifesto, but in practice, what they were saying yesterday doesn't lead one to suppose they are sound on the on the withdrawal.
But then obviously, if Britain decides it's all too much effort and let's just stay in or something, doesn't say very much for our nation's story if we're just too lethargic to do the grunt work, surely.
Well, I think our nation's story is also a story of a pragmatic nation.
Yes.
And if at the end of all this negotiation we find
doesn't make sense.
That we are where we first started. Do you remember that line from TSA? Like, we shall not cease from exploration, but the end of all our exploring will be to arrive at the place where we started and know it for the first time. I mean, it could be that that's where we get to. If, for example, just take immigration. Immigration. Yes, it obviously was, by any token, one of the issues which caused people to vote for Brexit. Well, if the only impact is going to be that, you know, at the margin, we might be able to have some control over notional immigration, but the downside is absolutely enormous in all other areas. You know, maybe that's not again worth the
Although,
fuss.
Can I get your thoughts on one policy area, actually? Because I think, as I recall rightly, you were part of the Environmentalists for Europe campaign.
I was the founder and the co-chairman.
So, with the new DEFRA secretaries, they've had a changeover recently. Andrea Leadsom to Michael Gove. Are you pleased? Is Gove a man who is more understanding?
I wrote a powerfully supportive argument on a website called Politics Home, saying it has to be good for the environment that a man of Gove's political stature takes on this job. Because, you know, he's a heavyweight. We haven't had a heavyweight politician there for a while. Obviously, we have had heavyweight politicians there in the past in the upsurge of their careers, like Heseltine in the 80s and so on. But yes, from that point of view, it has to be good. Although I did also, in the same article, said there's some things which Gove needs to be picked up on, like he was a little bit wobbly on climate change. He's made some disobliging remarks about habitat protection and, you know, infractions and so on and so forth. Well, you know, he's going to have to be kept... His nose is having to be kept to the grindstone, that's for sure.
But then, so you rate Gove as Environment Secretary, but how did you feel last year when he pulled the rug out from your son's leadership campaign?
Well, I think I made a three-word comment on the air. I was in Greece at the time.
You can say it now, if you like.
Yeah, I will. It was et tu, Brute, which is what I said. Which I'm sure you're
indeed. And, but there is the curiosity that story. And do you think that one day Boris's time will come? Sort of that he will, because he seems to be quietly laying low till 2019. Very pragmatic man, waiting till the Brexit deal's done.
Now, you're just asking me this as a political commentator. You're a political commentator. I'm a political commentator. I would say,
but you know the man better than many people.
No, I'd say at the present time, this is not where we are. I would say. I mean, I think Mrs. May was a little bit exaggerated when she said in her article in the Sun yesterday that she would have a few years. You know, I think a few years, maybe a little bit exaggerated, but I think you can certainly say that for the foreseeable future, we have a prime minister. And you know, I mean, basically, she has taken this task to heart, and I think she'll set her mind to it. It must be a pretty thankless task. I've got to say, it's not one would necessarily wish on any politician, but she's an honest lady. She's a determined lady, and I think at this present stage, between now and March 19th, 2019, March 29th, 2019, I can't think of an alternative than to go on the way we're going.
Although, can I raise one quote with you? That our former Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, in his new phase as Evening Standard editor, claimed that Boris was on a, quote, permanent leadership campaign. Do you think there's a sort of irrepressible ambition in the man?
Oh, I very much doubt if anybody goes into politics any more than anybody goes into any career without thinking about the next step in the ladder. When I was growing up, I was a classicist. It was called cursus honorum. If you remember, you were simply moving ahead. So, frankly, anybody who goes into politics and doesn't think about where he or the country is going would be crazy. But I can't conceivably. No, I think you might well find that a man of his enormous talents, I'm talking now about Boris, who can write. you know, he can write books, he can write articles. Mm. By the way, he paints pretty well. I wouldn't have said that he would necessarily say, look, you know, 20 years in politics, 25 years, call it a day. There are plenty of political, classical illusions. I mean, I think probably Fabius Cunctator comes to mind.
Mm.
Remember the chap who went off...
Oh, isn't it all Cincinnatus? He's called from his plough, Boris, and he saves the nation in a time after Brexit. Yes.
That is the one I'm thinking of. Fabius Cunctator was the chap who... Cunctator means he's constantly delaying.
Mm.
Yes, I mean, Cincinnatus. Yes.
Although I feel that it's a funny question, maybe, just because I feel it's invidious, obviously, to talk about one of your sons so much. So Joe Johnson,
he attracts
a lot of chatter as well about being a man of good integrity and leadership. Is he as capable for the top job, in your opinion? Obviously, the Johnson brand.
Let's go back and talk about compromat. That's fine.
Rate Joe?
I rate him enormously. I'm a man who got a double first in history. I mean, for heaven's sake. You know, these things count. On the other hand, Boris got won the Bracken race, so these things count too. You probably won the Bracken yourself, Asa.
Not yet. I sort of can go back and see, but but nonetheless, it's good to hear that you've got a lovely book there out there, and among 25 new books.
I have written 25 books.
Bravo.
This is my 25th book. This is the 10th novel. One of my novels is made into a film, and I do tell you that this is going to be filmed by Channel 4 as a 6-part TV series.
Ah, exciting stuff. Well, I look forward to seeing that. Thank you very much, Stanley.
Later. You're listening to the best of
I'm Asa Bennett, and it's my delight to welcome you to the latest show. Norman Lamb, the Liberal Democrats' health spokesman and a former minister in the coalition. Norman, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Now, you were there speaking to Theresa May, asking her to sit down for talks with you about social care. Have you had those talks yet?
We did meet with her.
Hmm.
I should incidentally say that we were talking not only about social care, but about the future of the NHS as well.
Hmm.
My argument...
Were you impressed by what she said?
Well, I was pleased that she was willing to meet with us.
Hmm.
And when we did meet with her, she agreed to us meeting with her health advisor in number 10 to continue the discussion about the sort of cross-party approach that I want to see take place. My frustration is that since then, we've had two meetings fixed up with her health advisor, both of which have been cancelled. The most recent was cancelled after the general election was called. And so I don't feel that the Conservatives have yet accepted the case for the need for the approach that I think has to happen. And I suppose what I'd say is that, you know, over the last fortnight, we've had this debacle with the Tories coming out with, I think, very ill-thought-through plans for care for elderly people, which will end up with very high charges for a lot of people for care at home.
It must have shocked you deeply, though, because you've worked with the Conservatives as a care minister. You were in the last government, so you understand these people.
It's deeply frustrating. On care for elderly people, I took the Care Act through Parliament with Conservative support. The Care Act included a cap on care costs of £72,000. It would have protected everyone against catastrophic loss. The Tories committed to implementing it in 2016, and then they abandoned it. And now
they've U-turned back into having a cap.
Well, they've flip-flopped in both directions, but they now say there will be a cap, but they won't tell us what the cap is. So extraordinarily, they're expecting people to vote for them without knowing what sort of protection will be available to them. I think that's extraordinary arrogance. I think people have a right to know before they vote what the level of protection will be.
And then certainly even many Tories were concerned about how absolutely bizarre this decision was and the resulting U-turn and all the rest of it. And then if I could just probe, given your experience of working with the Conservatives and government, and you, as I'm saying, you were a care minister, did you have to spend your years fending off more sort of absurd ideas like this?
Well, when you work with other people across political divides, you find that on some things you can reach agreement, and other areas where there is, you end up with frustration. The thing that I have felt and continue to feel very passionately
about... So in some way you weren't surprised they'd try this then?
Well, the Tories at the end of the coalition sort of spat us out after they'd used us for 5 years. They sought to destroy us, and it was pretty brutal. My particular passion is improved access for mental health care. People with mental ill health get treated appallingly by our NHS. They don't have the same right to get access to treatment on a timely basis. And the Tories, what frustrates me with the Tories is they pay lip service to it. They say they are committed to it, but they won't put the investment into making it happen.
But then, obviously, one of your policies is, in the Yes Minister language, it's quite brave to put a penny on income tax in order to fund the NHS. Obviously, it's not. It's going to hit working people if you do that. Surely, you're sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul if you're doing that. Surely.
Well, I think we all have a choice to make, and you know, this is in a way what elections are about. We all have to think very carefully. Do we want to ensure that our loved ones have access to care when they need it? I've had a couple where the husband has had diagnosed with cancer. He was told that the time he would have to wait for his operation was far too long for them, and they were deeply anxious about the situation. So they ended up paying privately thousands and thousands of pounds. But most people can't afford that. And I don't want to live in a country where people who have money can get access to treatment and people who don't have money are left waiting. So for me, as a citizen of this country, I'm prepared to pay a little bit more in order to ensure that our loved ones get care when they need it. And the fascinating thing is, on the doorstep, I'm getting people who say to me, look, I've voted Tory in the past, but I'm going to vote for you because I agree with the case for putting a penny on income tax. Per person, it's not that much, but it brings in total about £6 billion for the NHS and the care system, which could make a massive difference.
Of course, and the Tories would probably say that they were trying to raise money a different way then, by when it was for social care, by reshifting the costs so that people would still have to pay for it.
Yeah, so the Tory approach is that you just pay for it yourself. There's no what we call pooling of risk. The great value of taxation is that if we all pay a bit in, then we can protect ourselves, we can protect everyone from the risk of very significant loss if we end up with dementia or some other condition. The Tory approach is, well, if you get dementia, then you just pay for it all yourself. So the lottery of life is really harsh under the Tory approach. My approach is, let's pool risk, let's pay in a little bit each ourselves as a sort of insurance policy against the risk of getting dementia or some other awful condition. And I think that's a route to a much more civilised society.
But then I'm intrigued by your sort of obviously quite sort of genuine anger about the Tories' policies and proposals on this, because of course people would say that, you know, you served in the last coalition, you served with them in coalition, and you know, Andrew Lansley, of course, of the controversial Health and Social Care Act, you know, that caused massive outrage. I mean, do you think that was a mistake, Lansley's health reforms?
Well, I've never been a fan of those reforms, and during their passage through Parliament, I spoke out against the some of the implications were of the reforms taking place, and we managed to get some changes as a result. But I don't think that they made a lot of sense. I think the fragmentation of what we call commissioning, the organisations that hold the NHS money and which we use to pay for treatment, I think hasn't made sense. And so my argument is that we must try to join up care, join up health and social care, trying to create what we call integrated care organisations, so that you don't fall through the gaps between lots of different organisations. And that's that approach, to me, makes a lot of sense. It's got a lot of support within the NHS, but at the moment I see little hope of really achieving that change. And primarily my concern with the Tories is about their failure to invest sufficiently in the NHS. And that's why I come back to the point, we are prepared to make that difficult judgment call to say to the British people, there's a case of paying a bit more, all of us paying a bit more, in order to ensure that we get care when we need it.
Of course, although if I can sort of take you back to that sort of coalition, then, I mean, your leader, Tim Farron, has said that, I mean, you spoke out against the health reforms. Tim Farron said, actually, you guys should have, you know, voted against them and made this a real line in the sand. I mean, do you think he's right to say that?
Well, look, there's a case for... there will always be an argument as to whether we should have completely blocked the reforms rather than seeking to change them. And I'm very open in accepting that during the coalition, we made mistakes. I think it's really important if you're in public life to accept that if a mistake is made, to sort of be open and upfront about it. But I also think that there were things we did in the coalition that were immensely valuable, and I'm particularly proud of my work on mental health to give it the prominence and priority that it deserves. I'm proud of the fact that we legislated to introduce a cap on care costs, albeit that I'm now totally frustrated that the Tories have abandoned that policy. So there are lots of things that I feel very proud of, but also I acknowledge that we made mistakes as well.
OK, because then many of our listeners will be young voters who will remember the Liberal Democrats' time in coalition for their work with tuition fees, shall we say, the U-turn that had to happen. And so I imagine when they look, well, Tim Farron, for example, during the leadership campaign, I recall he said he'd give his party a 2 out of 10 rating for its time in coalition. I mean, would you be similarly dour, or would you be more optimistic, perhaps, given the tuition fees and what else you guys had to do?
No, I think we performed an incredibly important role, actually, in the interests of this country.
7 out of 10, then.
I guess that's about right, actually, because I've already acknowledged that we made mistakes. And too often politicians aren't willing to say that. But I think also, in the period between 2010 and 2015, we provided stability. We got the public finances into a much better state. And on universities, we made a dreadful mistake in committing to making the pledge about tuition fees. But what we ended up doing was to ensure that universities maintained their funding so that there weren't cuts to university support, which means, in a sense, that we've ensured that as many students are able to go to university as was the case before. It ensures that universities in this country remain world-class. But it also, we also made sure that the repayments you make as a graduate are strictly based on your ability to pay. So if you become very wealthy after doing your degree, you perhaps become a banker or a lawyer or an accountant, yes, you will pay a lot back in fees. But if you are on a low income following doing your degree, then you will actually pay less back than you did before. So it is a progressive system. And of course, at the end of your working life, if you haven't paid it off because you've been on a low income, then the rest
of the stats have borne this out.
Yeah, the rest of the debt is written off.
Oh, I can imagine.
So yes, we made mistakes, but we did guarantee continued funding of universities.
But then, if I could ask about the future. Like now,
yes, go on.
With the general election, of course, looking ahead to this, bearing these lessons in mind, because obviously when you've been talking about social care, it sort of strikes me there's a tone when you're speaking about it as if you wish you could have been in the room with the Tories, speaking good liberal sense in their ear, putting them off these things. And now I remember there's a recording of you maybe during the leadership election in which you said that the party should always be aiming to put liberal values into government, because if you can't do that, there's no point. And obviously Tim said it was a cop out if you guys didn't, at least be open to negotiations with other parties. So do you imagine, given the likelihood of a hung parliament, the polls indicate, that you would be open to talking with the Tories again or Labour about any sort of arrangement to support them?
Well, your question makes the assumption that, and you use the word the likelihood of a hung parliament.
Implied by the polls.
No, well, implied by one poll based on a different way of calculating likely outcomes.
Let's leave out the polls, but you have said before that the party should be open to putting liberal values into government.
Yeah, absolutely. But my answer to you is that I think in this election, in this moment in time, the Conservatives are very likely to be returned to power with probably a significant majority. And so I think in these circumstances, the important task is effective opposition, holding them to account on the NHS, on funding for education, where we're seeing a proposal to cut real-term spending per pupil by 7% by 2022, which is crazy so far as I'm concerned. So it's about effective opposition. So, and my party my party made a decision at the start of the election campaign, and we will stick.
So you're sitting this one out. If there was a hung parliament, you will not have any conversations.
We will not enter a coalition. We will not enter any other deal. We will seek to use our influence in parliament, as I always try to do with regard to the NHS and care issues, in order to achieve better outcomes for the people of this country.
But it's interesting, then you're saying that obviously to be an effective opposition, because to be an effective opposition, you have to have MPs naturally, and so you have to be really bouncing back. And obviously, the recent electoral performance in the local elections, for example, would suggest that that's been quite hard for Liberal Democrats. I mean, do you think, how optimistic are you as you look towards the next week? I know you're going to say we're fighting for every vote and all that, but how do you feel, how credible do you think it is that you'll be bounced back into, I know, 12 MPs? What will you be satisfied with?
I just think it's impossible for me at this particular point in the election process to make any rational judgment about how we're going to do. To be blunt and honest with you, I'm completely knackered. I've been working ludicrous hours every day as I seek to win my North Norfolk seat. I can't begin to make a judgment about the number of seats that we will win post-election, but I just make this point that whether we are a small party or a larger force, you can work with others in terms of individual issues. That's why I've led the case in Parliament, working with both Tory MPs and Labour MPs to get a cross-party consensus on the future of the NHS. That's the sort of approach that I try to take. I'm not a tribal politician. I will always work with other MPs from across the party spectrum in order to achieve results for people.
Now, Norman, I remember you are quite rightly respected for that. But then if I might, as a final question on the general election campaign so far, obviously, it's been a fascinating conversation with you on the NHS, I must say. But it saddens me in some ways, because in the general perception of things, people would think in a national conversation, the Liberal Democrats, all they stand for is being anti-Brexit, and that's it. I mean, do you feel there's been too much emphasis on opposing Brexit in your campaign?
Well, look, I've been very clear that I'm a Democrat and I accept the outcome of the referendum. And I think it's actually quite important to state that. I broke the party.
But do you think you've been stating it too much, sort of talking about Brexit?
Well, for me, the issues, when I go around talking to people on the doorstep, the issues that most people are concerned about are the NHS. If it's a young family with children, it's obviously about the future of schools and education, care for older people, and indeed other issues, the police force and so on. It's the normal stuff of politics that most people are concerned about. There is a subset of people who are very, very passionate about Brexit, indeed on both sides of the argument. But for me, the task now is to negotiate a deal that is in the best interests of this country. And that means maintaining close trading links with the EU, maintaining academic links, cultural links, and so forth.
Of course, but then... people just think, you know, they always call you Brimonas. They don't think about your, you know, because Jeremy Corbyn has monopolised the whole idea of being opposed to NHS cuts and how to sort of save it, how to oppose the dementia tax. You guys now have been relegated to a sideshow because they just think you're a Brexit one-man band. I mean, this is the risk, surely.
Well, look, I'm not running the national campaign.
If only you were, some people might think. If only you were. Now,
I couldn't possibly comment.
Oh, right. Well, maybe leave that. Although, if I can squeeze one last question in,
because
got a sort of friend of the show, you might say. You might recognise this man's voice if I play it now.
What's going on, world? It's me, Tinchy Strider, Cloud Knight.
So Tinchy Strider there, if you may have heard that.
Absolutely, I recognise it immediately.
You're good friends with him. Do you know, have you spoken with him during a campaign? Is he supporting you all the way? Is he a Liberal Democrat?
Our son had previously been his manager, not any longer. We actually remortgaged our house to help fund his first album. Which is perhaps slightly unusual for a politician to support a grime artist in launching his career.
Very brave decision.
Absolutely. But he ended up with two number one hits in 2009 and a number three. So I'm very proud of that. But we try to support both our sons in what they're doing. And I'm very proud of both of them. So, you know, that's the judgment call that parents have to make.
I take it Tinchy he's not a Liberal Democrat then, or have you spoken to him about politics?
I couldn't possibly speak about Tinchy, although yesterday I had Frank Bruno up supporting me in North Norfolk. He's a brilliant advocate for people with mental ill health, and he wanted to come up on a personal basis to support me in my campaign for re-election.
You're listening to the best of football
You're listening to Politics on Foodbar Radio with me, John Elledge. I'm now joined by the editor of the newspaper Schools Week and indeed a former teacher, Miss Laura McInerney. Hey, Laura, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm okay, thank you. Day after GCSE results, so a little tired.
Yeah, busy week for you guys. And they put it straight after A-levels week as well, which is, you know, I just don't think the government policy has been set with the needs of education journalists in mind, to be honest.
No, we have to think about the children. But it was an exciting day for many of them. There was about 600,000 people getting grades yesterday. So that's about as many people as live in Sheffield were yesterday getting GCSE grades.
Yeah, and it's easy to get blasé about this as you grow up and get old. But actually, you know, when you're a teenager, these are incredibly important life events, aren't they? These feel like, you know, the biggest thing in the world that day.
It's also really important for parents. So you have to remember those 600,000 children all have parents and grandparents and siblings, some of whom may be hoping that their brother or sister failed their exams. but it is, yeah, it's a really big day. And it's important because ultimately it then affects your next steps. Which college do you go to? What job do you take? What apprenticeship do you do?
So they've changed the GCSE grading system. It's now numbers rather than letters. I mean, is this really just an attempt to keep everyone confused the whole time? What's going on? What are the changes made of?
So there are purposes to this. The important thing to remember is that it was only English and maths this year, but it will be other subjects next year. And by 2019, instead of having A star to G, everyone will get a 9 to 1. 9 is the top grade. On purpose. One of the things we know that over time is generations tend to get smarter. So children do just generally drift towards braininess. And because of that, we sometimes need to add a grade. That's why the A star grade was added. Going to an A star star is not only a bit cumbersome, but if you're trying to do any spreadsheet analysis, it's a real nightmare. So we went to a number system. And it does mean that in the future, if there is genuine evidence that children have got brighter, we could add a 10 or an 11 grade and so on. It also, in the past, meant that about in some subjects, we were getting lots of children getting A stars. So people typically don't do music or drama unless they're pretty good at them. So you could end up with around 20% of children getting an A or an A star. And it meant that you couldn't tell who were the really, really good ones. So the 9 is an extra additional at the top. What's slightly problematic is nothing has really changed for the children at the bottom. And the government, for some reason, decided to make the 4 a standard pass and a 5 a strong pass. But it sounds a little bit like if you've got a 3, a 2 or a 1, you are essentially substandard. So it's not a helpful thing at the bottom end, but for those children who are very good, if you're exceptional at music or exceptional at English, then it's great for you.
This has always been something that confused me about the system, because it was the same with GCSEs, wasn't it? A C was seen as the pass grade, but there were Ds, Es, Fs, Gs. You know, there's a whole variety of fail grades there. And if you're like, is there any logic to this at all? What's the thinking?
So they weren't originally called fail grades. They are actually called pass grades. C was considered a good pass. So it was always called officially the good pass rate. And the reason they brought them in originally was because they put together two different qualifications. One was sat by children in grammar schools and one was sat by children who didn't make it in. They mushed the two together and kind of said the middle point is the point at which was the old bottom of the grammar school one. So that's why C was considered a good pass. But the rest were pass grades. It's only really in the last maybe 7 or 8 years that we've started this fail word popping in. So a D was somehow a fail. And that came about because when the Labour government decided to start bringing measurements of schools in, they said we're going to use the C grade and above as the rate at which we're going to measure the school. And that is when the shift came. It should never have been the case that a D or an E or an F is a fail for a child.
It does feel like that's conflating two different things. It's like measuring the children's achievement and you know, what they're going to do next in life, and measuring the school's achievement. And we often have one set of numbers to measure those two things, but they're very different ideas, right?
Exactly. And unfortunately, about 20 years ago, when David Blunkett was bringing in these school measures, it was important. Comprehensives were not in a good state in the 1990s. There needed to be more of a focus. So they brought these measures in around GCSEs and said it's no longer acceptable that only 5 in every 100 children is passing a few of them. You need to get more over the line. Unfortunately, in that 20 years, it has become conflated. And so children's achievement is seen as a reflection of adults' work, those teachers' work, and the pressure has ramped up, the language has changed, and we found ourselves in this very odd situation where yesterday, not only do you have children panicking about their GCSEs, but on Wednesday night, I had head teachers ringing me, you know, wondering whether they should be going in and resigning the next day. They're really stressed out about this. So, you know, it's a bit of give and take. It needed to get better, but it is a bit of a problem now.
And there is also this phrase you hear, you know, teaching to the test. If you're measuring schools by their results in these exams, then they're going to focus a lot more on getting the kids through these exams. But there should be more to education than that, right? It's not just about getting a piece of paper at the end of the year.
Yeah, so the school's chief inspector, Amanda Spielman, has said that from this year, the school's inspectorate, who go in and check and see whether or not children are being taught properly, will in fact be inspected on how broad their curriculum is. So even though you're going to have this test measure, and you're going to have to teach really well and make sure this kid gets the grade, you're also going to have to make sure that other things are not going by the wayside and that children do still get access to music when they're 12. Lots of schools are pulling back on music education at the moment, for example. That's going to have to stay in there. Otherwise, you do risk your Ofsted grade, which is the other measure by which schools are looked at.
To what extent is all this just a reflection of the fact that politicians have an urge to muck around with things? Like, if education ministers often don't serve in the post for that long. Like, Michael Gove was around for quite a long time, actually, but generally speaking, they'll do like 18 months or something. And in terms of their own career and their own end of term grades, they will feel the need to be able to point to something that they actually did. So it sometimes feels to me like we're a lot of these things, not just in education, but in all sorts of bits of public policy, ministers are pushing changes so that they can say they made a change.
That's definitely the case. And also, they don't always understand what came before. There's a great game in the TV show MasterChef that they sometimes run called a relay race. And each person in the team has 15 minutes with a set of ingredients. And the first one sets it off and then they leave after 15 minutes. The next one comes in and they have to try and work out what's in the oven. It's half baked. Was I supposed to be boiling these potatoes? And that's what's happened with these GCSE reforms. Michael Gove had a plan and it involved all the students across all of the grades. Nicky Morgan then came in and didn't really understand it and said, we're going to have a five grade, there's the strong. Justin Greening's come in and she's tried to do something else. And you're right, that baton passing doesn't work well. It would be nice if we could get to a situation where maybe you had to be a junior minister and get promoted up to being a senior minister, like you would with most jobs.
Yes, now there are, this is something I've been thinking about a lot this week, there are certain people in the cabinet who you can tell are there not because of any talent or understanding of policy, but purely because within the internal politics of the Conservative Party, it's a bit difficult to sack, not mentioning any Chris Graylings in particular. But, you know, there are definitely ministers there who, if they were working in the private sector, they would probably not have survived at the top for quite so long, I suspect.
I think so. We've certainly seen over the last few years as well that there is a consideration sometimes put in to where the education secretary themselves went to school. I don't think it was a coincidence that Justine Greening has claimed to be the first mainstream comprehensively educated secretary of state. She is. I mean, that's fair enough. David Blunkett went to a state school, but it was a special needs school. So it's difficult to say it was a comprehensive school. But actually she was. And I do think that had a bearing on her being selected. And she's very good at some things, but I can't say that when I speak to Justine Greening, I feel a great sense of passion and burning for education policy, and that is causing some problems.
Do you think both we in the media and people in politics sometimes overestimate the extent to which politicians can affect change in the education system?
They can't affect change often in the classrooms themselves. That's fair enough in terms of the teaching. But the exam reform system pretty much can only be changed by a politician. And that is quite surreal because it's a really important part of what happens in schools. And it is only ever reformed by somebody who is usually trying to make a political point, lasts about 3 years and then walks off before it's actually sat by anybody.
Yes, now the whole system does feel very strange. Like, Michael Gove is long gone, but his reforms, we're finding out now whether what they'll actually mean, and we'll find out some point in the future whether they worked.
You're listening to the best of FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio presents.
FUBAR Radio presents.
Politics on FUBAR.
Hello and welcome to Politics on FUBAR. It's Asa Bennett here and, well, Today we're going to be talking about what's meant to be a very controversial topic, immigration, the I word. And I've got the pleasure to have David Campbell Bannerman on the line. Hello.
Hi, Asa. How are you doing?
Wonderful to hear from you now. Thank you much. I was in the middle of embodying what people were sort of talk about if they were sort of hard border fans who wanted us to clamp down immigration. So I can't resist asking, actually, then, you know, as a seasoned Brexiteer who is excited now to be losing his job in 2 years' time, Britain getting its independence, do you want even Britain to have immigration go down or up?
Oh, I want it to go down, definitely. It's what the British people want. It's not, it's important to understand, you know, immigration is a good thing. We're not really arguing that point. But you do need to control the numbers. I mean, two reports just this week, where we had the population rise of over 500,000 in the last year. And 1 in 10 people in this country are now foreign. Now, you know, as I said, I welcome a lot of that. But it's about numbers. It's about managing the numbers. It's a management thing, not a sort of trying to bring an end to immigration. And I think people really want to see that because our population is rising at a huge rate. And we can't provide enough schools or hospitals or roads to meet that need.
But then some of your colleagues, like Daniel Hannan, he doesn't mind, actually, if it goes up instead.
Well, Dan has a different view. He's more of an economic liberal than I am. You know, I understand the reality of that. But
doesn't
the problem
it mean
is when
one of you is going to be very unhappy in 2 years' time?
Well, I think Dan is pretty happy, as I am, with Brexit. This is an area of difference in terms of the scale of immigration. I do think it needs management and control. I mean, if we lived in a sort of perfect world where all the economies around the world were about the same, you wouldn't have the issue. And in fact, when we first started in the EEC with six nations, and it went from there, there wasn't really much of an issue. But since 2004, our population has gone up about 7 million. And this has created real pressure on our public services, particularly London and the South East. And I think it has become a massive issue. You know, we cannot build a Birmingham for every 2 years. That's the rate we're going. We're having to build a house for an immigrant every 5 minutes. And I think the British people just say, look, hang on a minute, you know, we do like immigration, but we want to manage the numbers.
But then in terms of what Brexit can do to answer that, now, as someone who sort of went from the Conservatives to UKIP and back again, you'd understand better than many sort of what led people, you know, from supporting the Conservatives to be disaffected, annoyed, and then I know that you returned because you thought that, right, you know, we're serious about getting a referendum, the Conservatives are the best bet of getting Britain out of the European Union. However, your old colleagues in UKIP, what's left of it, the sort of the husk that remains these days, they insist actually that, you know, they will come back with a vengeance because there's going to be betrayal, there's going to be fudge, compromise, and that means you voters and people like you may well come back. Do you think that right?
Well, it's possible. I think, though, the future of UKIP is to take Labour voters and working
class. So it's possible there'll be betrayal and fudge, you're saying?
Well, no, I'm not saying that, but I think that's the only future for UKIP. I don't think there's going to be betrayal and fudge. I mean, I think there will be a vigorous debate on the type of immigration policy we're going to put forward. Obviously, there's an immigration bill. There's one of the 8 Brexit bills. That will give a bit more detail, but it's probably more of a framework. I mean, all we're really saying is that let's have a similar immigration system to Australia or Canada or United States, which obviously they all welcome immigrants coming into the nation, but they do manage the numbers far better than we do. We have an opportunity post-Brexit. I mean, to date, we've only been able to control half our immigration, so we've been over tough on Indian students or Australians or Canadians. You know, we can rebalance our immigration system, so it's actually fairer to non-EU.
But then that's the goal, of course. But then in terms of getting there and getting everything, sort of having a big, audacious, you know, good Brexit deal, it's sort of curious, because everyone seems to... There's a whole narrative of who has the cards, who has the better hand, you know, what can we trade away, in a sense. Now, Theresa May, obviously, I'm sure you've studied the Lancaster House speech, you know, as well.
Yeah.
There was a lovely line in there where she said, sort of, this will require creative thinking.
thinking on both sides. You know, there'll be sort of compromise is necessary. Yes. So, and obviously you're saying it is possible that there'll be sort of compromise that leads to sort of disaffected people, you know, running off. What do you think Britain would have to or may end up having to trade away?
Well, I think it's firstly, it's worth saying that, look, we have had immigration under control in the past. In the 1990s, it was under control. It wasn't really an issue. And what we're saying is let's get back to
but
those kind of levels.
What will Britain trade away for a good Brexit?
Well, I don't think we'll have to trade away. Look, we're taking
Theresa May says she's ready to. She's ready.
Brexit. Well, there's negotiations will go on. But, I mean, you know, we are being a sovereign, independent nation. And a lot of this actually isn't relevant to the Brexit talks, to an extent. It is when it comes to EU citizens and their rights, etc. And I welcome the generous package we've offered on that. But you know, a lot of this is about who do we let in? What skills shortages are there?
But do you think the trade away will come in the form of money? People? We'll just have to pay them. We'll have to cross their hands with silver.
I don't think there's any. They want access to our market. We are their largest trading customer. We have to stop talking ourselves down that, you know, they're going to do us a big favour. You don't deal that way. What you're going to say is, look, the EU wants access to our markets. We're the fifth largest economy in the world. We're their largest trading partner. They want to come and study in Britain, etc. So, look, let's do a deal that works both ways. And, you know, I want the EU to get a good deal as well. You know, we've got to be friends and neighbours. But I don't think, you know, throwing cash around is the right way. I mean, how much are they going to pay for our market, for access to our market, if you get into that?
We'll have to see. Although I'm afraid I might have to butt in there, because I would love to obviously talk to you for as long as practically the Brexit negotiations are going on. But I'm afraid I have to wind up because the show is nearing its end. So, David Gemmell-Bannerman, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
Till next time.
Nice to hear from you. You're listening to the best of
football. Welcome back to Politics on FUBAR. It's Asa Bennett here, and I have the pleasure to have on the line Baroness Pauline Neville-Jones, the former Security Minister, former Chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee. From your perspective, it must be, I don't know how you must have been feeling sort of the last few weeks, seeing, you know, hacking and cybersecurity continually in the headlines, it seems, you know, Parliament being under siege practically, and the NHS attacked with ransomware. I mean, is anyone safe these days?
Is anyone safe these days?
Yes. I mean, if Parliament, you think they might be able to afford good security, if they can be brought down in terms of remote working by hackers?
Well, of course, the security of the parliamentary system, like any system, depends upon the discipline of its users. My understanding is that the reason why the parliamentary system was penetrated was because there were some very weak passwords being used by members of the system, and I don't know whether which house they were in or whether they were staff, but certainly people linked into the system, you know, weren't doing the elementary things which can help guarantee safety for everybody. And that's the problem, is you only have to have, you know, one weak password, one failure in the system, and of course it can lead to, you know, the whole network being brought down. And so one of the features of cybersecurity is the shared responsibility, because you have to be, you know, when you join into the network, you're responsible not only for your own security, but you actually affect and are part of other people's security.
So our theory
is
that,
you know, not I mean, if you lock your house, you know, you're responsible for locking your house. But actually, in the case of cyber, you know, if you don't lock your house, then it's a whole road. It's you know, much larger organisation that's potentially prejudiced.
And do you think you worked in government, and so you'd have rubbed shoulders with these people who are trying to fend off hackers, keeping us safe? Do you feel that they understood the scale of the challenge?
Well, I think that those who are looking at the threat that we face certainly do understand the extent of the challenge. And they do a great deal to send out information and warnings and to share their information about the threat, the threat picture. The issue is the extent to which people then actually act on that information that they're given. Now, I don't suppose they would say, you know, that they're perfect and they know everything that's going. But there is a gap, undoubtedly, between the knowledge that we have collectively and the extent to which people actually take the precautions necessary.
And that's why they keep
getting
through.
That's where we have to fill that gap between awareness and action.
But then with awareness, obviously hacking is such a widely used term these days, and that it seems every event in politics now has some nefarious interference going on in the US presidential election. And more recently, Labour MP Ben Bradshaw, I think in the chamber, he suggested that the EU referendum was quite probably hacked. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know about the EU referendum. I mean, I just don't have any information to that effect. I mean, I don't exclude it because I don't know, but I don't have information on it. I think it is fairly, it is actually an established fact that the Democratic National Committee was hacked. The Russians deny, of course, doing it, but I think there's fairly widespread
questions about who exactly.
Indeed, they were interested in all of that. Well, you see, one of the issues, of course, is why do people do this? And here there was a political motivation. Some hacks, like the one, for instance, that the NHS was caught up with. It does look very much as if, you know, they launched a piece of malware. They didn't realize how far it would actually spread, and it was financially motivated. It turned out to be much bigger, I think, than they themselves realized would be the case. And it shows how easily an organization can get caught up in something that's not actually directed at it. You don't necessarily these days have to be targeted in order to be a victim. In the case of the Americans and Ben Bradshaw was talking about, here is something that people call hybrid warfare.
Yes.
That's to say, using cyber means as actually for political purposes. And
I mean, if I could steer us back to Britain,
that's when you get into the realm of states using cyber against each other.
I mean, because I know obviously you're not privy to the information the American services would have, so we may be having a sort of we may be talking at sort of arm's length about the issues over there. But then, if I could bring us back to sort of Britain in one way, I remember during the referendum campaign, at least, that you were very robust in talking about the security and how in striking down the Leave side's arguments that that the EU was stopping Britain from being safe and secure against threats, be it cyber or...
Well, I stick by that.
Indeed. So do you feel, as we are negotiating our way and making our way out of the European Union, there was something that stuck in my mind, which is when Theresa May put in that letter to Donald Tusk, the sort of suggestion that no deal might well throw up intelligence arrangements in the air. I mean, do you think that was a wise decision to mention that? And do you agree that it would be calamitous if there was no deal for intelligence sharing and security?
I think that no deal would harm both sides. It does not make sense to me for the existing cooperation to be damaged in any way, because the benefit is undoubtedly shared. We do help undoubtedly continental European security because our intelligence base is good, and we make information from it available to others who are threatened. The reverse is also true. There is gathering of information in continental Europe from which we benefit, and we benefit also from the extensive police cooperation that goes on. So it's not a good idea actually to sever that or to damage it. And one of the things I very much hope in these negotiations on Brexit is that we will arrive at some agreement. There's a lot of these things, some of them, but a lot of these things don't have anything to do with EU structures. And we ought to be able to continue them, even in the absence of not being a member of the EU. Some of them are EU-related, and we will lose ground, unfortunately, as we leave, because we won't any longer, for instance, be able to head the European Police Organization, Europol, which is very valuable, and we have a Brit there in charge. And that's a loss. It's a pity.
But then, if you look at countries,
we'll have to try and make up for it.
But obviously, there are countries like Norway and those who are sort of semi-out in EFTA, EEA, all sorts of half-in, half-out arrangements.
Yeah.
Do you feel that then, Britain, that these existing security arrangements would be just as effective in that sense, or is it just the only way is down? The only way is it's less effective.
Well, I find it hard to believe that you are as effective outside as you would be inside. For one thing, we won't any longer have the capacity actually to influence further decisions that are taken, or at least be part of the decision making. We'll be able to influence them, but we won't be part of the decision making machine.
Although we have
been very powerful in making decisions on security in Europe. And a lot of the airline security, for instance.
But there wouldn't be a divergence of aims.
As a result of direct British action.
There wouldn't be a divergence of aims, surely. I mean, the Britain and the EU27 would still be united against terror and hacking. The principles apply.
I'm not arguing that would be the case. Mm. What I am saying is that Britain's comparative position in relation to the decisions that are taken and the institutional developments and, you know, what happens after we leave the European Union, there we are in a less influential position and we don't have any power actually to join in the decisions that are actually taken, though I would hope we would at least be able to influence them. So it does change things. I don't think one can you know, deny that. Mm. What I hope is we can set up structures of a kind where consultation is sufficient, that our ability to at least influence the decisions that are taken is real and forms part of the basis on which then others will then take those decisions.
And one can assume the Prime Minister would obviously agree with you, given her days as a former Home Secretary. She would want to have, and indeed she fought, alongside you.
Her argument for when she was a Remainer, yes. I mean, her argument precisely was that it benefits Britain.
Yes, and so she agrees, indeed. And so with this in mind, and you know, given how she's had to change, be very pragmatic, because you're the only person right now in this conversation who's ever worked with her and knows what she's like in private. I mean, do you think she's got the right sort of temperament and character to handle these Brexit negotiations smoothly?
Well, these negotiations are going to be very tough, and you do need stamina. And one of the things that undoubtedly Theresa May showed when she was Home Secretary was very considerable stamina. You know, she
a bloody difficult woman, as Ken Clark
said. Very important. It's very important also that she takes the team with her.
Mm. Can she be a bloody difficult woman, as Ken Clark said?
Yes. I think that on the whole that's correct. But you know, you don't get very far in life unless you're prepared to stand your ground. You're listening to the best of